history through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, brought to you by Paul Everett's RV Country, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are heroes around you, maybe even living right next door to you. And when we take the time to listen to their stories, it sure changes our perspective. We want to honor our veterans for their service and their sacrifice, preserve their stories so we don't forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And along the journey, we sure are educated, we're entertained, and so often even inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. This week is when our country sets aside a day to give thanks. But do we really know how much we have to be thankful for? Do we really appreciate the freedom that over a million Americans have died to preserve, that countless others have bled for, have carried physical and emotional scars for decades in order to preserve? One group of people that really gets it when it comes to freedom, those who have had to live in the absence of freedom. Over the years, I've had the privilege to sit down with dozens of ex-prisoners of war, including quite a few who have shared their stories here on Hometown Heroes. In fact, if you were to peruse the podcast at hometownheroesradio.com, you'd find at least 37 ex-prisoners of war from 10 different states. Every story is unique, but there's one thing that those men all have in common. Whether they were in captivity for a month or maybe even the entire war, once they were liberated, they never took their freedom for granted again. And really, why should we? My hope today is that as we prepare for Thanksgiving this week, we would arrive at an even deeper level of gratitude by listening to some of these ex-POWs, a little bit of what they went through, and just how much our flag, our country, and our freedom means to them. We'll start with Dean Whitaker of Las Vegas, Nevada, whose first mission as a teenage bombardier with the 398th Bomb Group came just after D-Day in 1944.
I guess Eisenhower requested Air Force help, so we went in at a low altitude. We usually flew at about 28,000 feet. On this mission, I think it was at 5,000 or so feet. And every gun German had, it was shooting at us. I could see the flashes from the ground of them shooting at us, and we knew exactly when we flew over enemy lines when all this flashing started. We were getting hit once in a while. I could smell it every time we got hit, the burning of the material against the aluminum. And this happened quite a bit. We dropped our bombs and turned around, and the plane next to us got hit real bad, and it exploded, and nobody got out of that. And it was quite a sight. It lasted me quite a while. But on the way back, just we went over the lines, we got hit again. The instrument panel in the plane and the nose got shot out, and the hydraulic line from the controls is red, and we had this red come all over us, and the navigator that was up with me thought he was shot. He saw, oh my gosh, this red is coming out of my chest. Well, he rubbed it and found out that it was hydraulic fluid, so he felt great. But in the meantime, when the nose got shot out, I had a face full of plexiglass, and I could hardly see, and it was burning really bad. So we got back to the base, and they took me to the base hospital, cleaned my eyes out, and in the following few days, my eyes were swollen shut, and so I was off flying duty for 2 weeks, and as soon as they healed, I could see again, I was back. I think I missed just one mission because of that. It was a terrible situation because the plane had gotten hot. Pretty bad. One engine was out and one engine was feathering, and we weren't making much headway. And I thought, boy, we'll be lucky to get back to base. But you know, the Lord is with me, and that really helped.
Amen to that. And I think through the rest of your story, we're going to see that as well. I have to ask you, if you had a nearly fatal crash before you ever flew a mission, and then you got hit in the eyes and couldn't see after your first mission, were you a little hesitant to go on more missions after that?
You know, being an 18-year-old kid, you really are kind of fearless. You think, well, somebody's got to make it out of this, and I'm going to be the one. And you have that attitude that it's kind of a devil-may-care attitude, and you don't scare that easy. We would always meet under our plane before a mission, and everybody say a little silent prayer, and this helped.
He eventually would get the Purple Heart 60 years later, but little did Dean know at the time that darker days were ahead. On November 2, 1944, the target would be the heavily defended synthetic oil plant in Merseburg, Germany. It was his 20th mission, and it would prove to be his last.
When I looked ahead and saw the flak, which is the black explosion of 88-millimeter shells going off, I thought, Mike, we're going to be lucky to get through this. And we got through it fine. We were hit a few times. All I could tell when you were hit that we could smell the burning hot flak metal going through the ship. And we got out of that fine. And as soon as we were out of that, the Luftwaffe attacked us. The first attack, they always attack from the tail because their 20-millimeter cannon would go further than our 50-caliber machine gun. The tail gunner was really busy on that first mission, and I think he shot down one of the planes. One of the fellows said, you got one, over the intercom. And so on the second attack, we were hit really bad. The tail gunner was shot bad, and the waist gunner went back to check on him, and he did. He said he's dead. By that time, we were hit real bad, and the plane was out of control. The pilot gave the word to bail out, and me being the navigator, right by the nose escape hatch, I was the first one out. Before I could go out, I had to release. I wore what they called a flak suit. Armor vest. There's an escape tag on that that you pull, and it's supposed to be released. Well, it didn't release, and I was fighting that, trying to get that off, and I said, man, I got to get out of here. And, you know, I had a voice kind of, my father had passed away about 8 months before I went in the service, and I thought I heard his voice say, you get out of there now. So I did. Wanted to jump out. I said, I can't wait any longer. I jumped out of the escape hatch of the nose. And as soon as I hit the slipstream, it tore the flak suit off. But my parachute was only fastened on one side because I couldn't fasten the other side when the flak suit was on. So here I was fighting all the way down, trying to fasten the other side. And at 28,000 feet, you have no strength. You're just ready to pass out. And so I started entering some clouds at 3,000 feet. And I said, well, I better pull this now, whether it's fastened or not. And I pulled it, and I was floating down, and I could hear shots coming up at me. And the Germans were shooting at me as I was coming down.
And this was fire from their aircraft or from the ground?
Well, that was from the ground. It was civilians in the ground were shooting. They all had guns. And then the odd thing about this, when I was, before I hit the ground, I could hear cheering. And I thought, who the heck is cheering in the middle of Germany? And I just about landed in a German prisoner of war camp that held English prisoners. And luckily, a guard from this camp come running out of the camp and made the civilians stop shooting me. They had their rifles already aimed at me, and so they stopped shooting, and the guard gathered me up and took me into this camp, and the English prisoners of war gave us tea and crumpets. It was really something. Four members of my crew were not that lucky. They landed too far away for this soldier to save them, and they were killed by the German civilians, and they later paid for it when the GIs came in. And they had a trial, and I have the names of all the soldiers that did that. And I think they were executed for doing that.
Well, that's understandable. And I'm just struck, we talk about close calls, and you've already described a couple close calls in the air. But here, out of just the sheer chance of the order in which you get out of the airplane and where you come down, you could have been killed by angry German civilians. Instead, you landed where you were safe.
Yes, it was really safe. Then I did notice when I got down that my parachute was fastened on both sides. And I don't know. I had some help there.
So you have no idea how that other side got fastened?
No, it was done.
Yes, it was. But now you're a prisoner, and after more than a month at Stalag Luft 3 in what is now Poland, they take you out, march you guys 10 days through the snow in the dead of winter, and after that long march, they stick you in boxcars designed for 40 men or 8 horses, but the Germans stuffed a whole lot more than that in there.
We got in these 48s, and they were so crowded you had to stand. There was no room to sit. There was a few guys who were pretty sick, and we'd make room for them to lay down. One occasion, it's Christmas time, and somebody started singing Silent Night. The whole train caught on to that, and you could hear a trainload of GIs singing Silent Night.
Something tells me that each Christmas now, when you hear that song, you probably go back to that 40 and 8.
Yeah, that's true. It sure reminds you of that occasion, because it was really hard sleeping in those cars, standing up. And I think we were relieved 2 times to get out and go to the bathroom. And in those 2 days or 3 days on that train, I don't recall just exactly, but it was an ordeal.
So it was probably a relief when you arrived at your next destination, even though you were a prisoner there.
Yes, we crossed the Danube, I believe it was, and then this got little town of Moosburg. It wasn't a city, it was a town, and we marched through that town, and all the German civilians were hanging out of their window with a swastika. Later on, after we were liberated, we walked by that same town, and all the white flags were out.
That's a sharp contrast, and a very good one on the second half of that. So at this new prison camp, were the conditions the same? Were they worse? And had your morale been impacted at all by all this that you've been through?
No, it was worse. The facilities were bad. We had no place to sleep. They had put up some temporary tents. And the first night, we slept in an old barn that had so many leaks in it. And I tried to find a place to sleep that wasn't getting dripped on. Couldn't find it. Everything leaked. But the next day they took us into temporary tents, and this was so crowded. When you slept, you had to sleep on the floor, and everybody was sleeping on the floor, and there was no room. If you had to get up at night, you had to walk over all these bodies. Unluckily, I had dysentery at the time and had to get up a few times during the night. But this dysentery enabled me to go into sick call, which was a permanent barracks that was run by a pre-med student, an Air Force captain. So he treated me, and I'll tell you a little story about him now. On our liberation, well, the first day we saw this infantry spotter planes coming over, and knew they were spotting for the artillery. They sighted us and knew we were there. So I think there was 5,000 American officers in this camp. The next morning, we could hear the tanks. They were really making a lot of noise, rumbling. And every once in a while, they'd shoot some. The Germans, was broken up into the Luftwaffe guards, who treated us decently, and SS troops that were guarding us. Two different type individuals. When they heard the tanks coming, the Luftwaffe soldiers wanted to surrender to us, and they started coming into our camp. There was a road leading to our camp from a cheese plant next to us, and the SS troops started shooting their own soldiers that were coming into our camp. And the road coming into the camp, you could see the bodies of a few of them, and they were shooting up our camp too. And I got into a slit trench we had built, trying to get protected from the shots being fired into our camp. And one of the shots missed me about 12 inches, I guess. It hit the reeds that were supporting this slit trench. As soon as the tanks saw the shooting from this tower, they shot it. And boy, that tire just blew to pieces by the tanks' guns. All right, then that was in the morning. As soon as everything was cleared out, the tanks came into camp. I have a picture of the soldier, the infantryman, shooting the lock off of the gate to the camp. And behind him came the tanks. Were we ever glad to see them? Then, I don't know what the time was, and then a little bit later, after the tanks, General Patton came in with the tanks. I was in sick bay, which was in the first building, and I was standing at the stoop waiting to greet them. I didn't know he was coming, but he came over to the stoop, to the camp, to the door where I was, and asked me, he says, "How you doing, son?" I says, "Fine now that you're here, General." Well, he was there to see his son-in-law, the medical medic I was telling you about. It was his son-in-law. His son-in-law got hit by one of these stray bullets, but luckily it had gone through the building and it's pretty well spent. They did carry him out, but he was fine.
I look at your wall here in your home in Las Vegas, and you have a very well preserved and document, the docket with German text and a picture of a young American POW with his fingerprint. How did you come to possess that paper from the German files that documented your captivity?
When the war is over, we could do pretty well what we want. Well, I went to the headquarters of the Luftwaffe there, and it was in all a mess. You know, they'd taken all the files and scattered them over. Well, I found this German ID on the floor, a picture of me. It was my ID, and I said, gee, I'm going to keep that. So I did. I still have it today. The writing is in German. I can't understand it, but the picture is me.
No doubt about it, and they spelled your name right. When you see that on your wall, and it's not too far from your Purple Heart or your Caterpillar Club for bailing out of an airplane, the wings that you wore, and a picture of your crew. But when you see that picture of you as a prisoner of war, what does it mean to you? Does it trigger something in your mind? Does it have a significance to you when you look at that?
Oh, yes, it sure does. It just reminds me how fortunate I was to escape that and to live a nice life afterwards.
So for the rest of us, how does that compare to the things we're grateful for this Thanksgiving week? You'll find links and photos connected to the veterans you hear today at hometownheroesradio.com. And up next, we'll go from Europe to the Pacific and hear from a man who survived the Bataan Death March. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. If you'd like to sell your low-mileage, well-maintained RV in excellent condition, bring it to Paul Everett's RV Country and they'll sell it for you. That's right. Consignments are welcome. Any type of motorhome, travel trailer, or fifth wheel. With 8 locations in 5 states, there's probably a Paul Everett's within driving distance of this radio station. Helping RVers get the most out of their RVs is another one of those things that make doing business with Paul such a unique pleasure. Paul Everett's RV Country in Fresno and Indio, California, Bullhead City, Arizona, Laughlin, Nevada, Coburg, Oregon, and 3 locations in Washington, Fife, Milton, and Mount Vernon. For the exact locations, go to the website. That address is rvcountry.com. That's rvcountry.com. Over 55 years of experience and 1 million RVers served. Paul Everett's RV Country, proud supporters of Hometown Heroes.